intelligence officers. I've got to call Langley. I also have to call Islamabad Station and tell Appleton about the nuclear waste theft. He thought for a moment. Maybe I don't tell him about Kyber. Not just yet. Vance cocked his head. Why would you keep the station chief out of the loop on that? Because somebody who knew about our raid in Lahore told the local police about our raid in Lahore. They prevented it at the last minute. You don't think, Hanley shrugged. This is Appleton's fiefdom. He might have spoken to someone who blew the whistle. If you ask me, he's been in country too long. Julie spoke now with surprising emotion in her voice.
You have 12 operators, Mr. Hanley. Only 12. If there are a dozen defenders at Ismail Zai, or maybe 24, then an attack on that compound will be very dangerous for them.
Hanley said, I'm going to push to get some SEALs folded into this op. Maybe some conventional military as well. The Rangers stationed at Salerno will need UAVs, comms, a joint operation plan. It will take time, but I need you guys working around the clock to give us the best intelligence picture you can find. He pointed to Vance. Better than the last go-around at this base. Vance headed out into the hall, followed by Julie Marquez. We'll get everything we have on the compound and forces there to you within a few hours. 47. 220 miles from Camp Chapman in Afghanistan, Fatima Jinnah Park in Islamabad, Pakistan was quiet, dark, and empty at 5 a.m. As Ted Appleton strolled along a leafy footpath, he felt as if he were the only person for miles around, though he was in the center of a metropolis with 1 million inhabitants. Still, a cold shiver of fear tingled in his body. He had been slipped out of the U.S. Embassy in the trunk of a car 90 minutes earlier, then dropped off by himself to run a 60-minute surveillance detection route. His meeting this morning absolutely could not be disrupted by the ISI watchers who pestered him much of the time, so special measures and utmost discretion had been mandatory. He walked alone through the darkness now, felt the cool wind that rustled leaves and branches on either side of him, and then, when he arrived at a park bench below a Himalayan cedar, he sat down. Checking his phone, he saw he'd received no new texts or calls, so he waited, far away from the smoky light of gas lamps closer to the street at the edge of the park. His agent arrived right on time, as he knew she would. They had a long history together, after all, and this experience meant Appleton also knew she would be scared. But she had called for this meeting. The stakes were the highest they'd ever been since the two had been together. And running a CIA station, Appleton knew, was all about deciding when to avoid risks and when to take them. Managing risk. Intelligence work was, he had decided while working with Emil Vaziri, very much like love. Leopard sat down next to him, and he smelled her perfume, but he couldn't tell if she'd put it on just for him or if she'd been wearing it anyway. He chastised himself for thinking about such things at a time like this, and resolved to stick to the business at hand as much as he possibly could. He was about to say something when Leopard spoke, with strength in her voice.
They are watching the embassy, you know.
Of course they are, darling, Appleton replied. I took steps.
What steps?
What steps? First a ride in a trunk, then I was dropped off at Noor Railway Station, then I took a taxi to a safe house we have. From there, I climbed on a bicycle and made my way back to the park, locked my bike up at a lamppost and walked for 10 minutes. He added, we're safe.
Emil Vaziri nodded, her relief evident, and then she slowly unwrapped the dupatta from her face. She looked at Appleton. He read it as a cue for a kiss, but before he had a chance to lean in and part his lips, she said,
Director Khan has disappeared. Leadership says he's gone rogue. Reaching out to assets at home and abroad for his own aims, not sanctioned by ISI.
Appleton sighed for a number of reasons, and then he recovered quickly. He said,
Can there be any doubt now? He is Pasha the Kashmiri, and he is in play.
He told her about the news he'd just received regarding the possibility that nuclear fuel had been stolen at Chashma, and she put her face in her hands. When she lifted her head, she said,
I have been providing intelligence to the Americans about a terrorist organization that works out of my own fucking organization. How could I be such a fool?
He put his arm around her, damning protocol once again because of his affection for his agent.
You aren't a fool. Your intelligence product has been valuable. Khan gave you no indication whatsoever he was the enemy.
Just as long as you don't think that I had anything to do with any of...
Appleton put a finger to her lips.
Of course not. You are the best asset America has in this part of the world.
He smiled.
And I love you.
She let it go, but he could see the pain on her face.
I love you,
she said, rubbing a single tear from her eye. He fought the urge to kiss her again, and he said,
Is that why you called me here tonight? To tell me Khan had disappeared?
That, and something else. Something unrelated to the KRF.
If it's unrelated to the KRF, then it will have to take a back seat for the time being. All we care about right now are...
This is about China,
Leopard interjected.
Does America care about China?
Appleton cocked his head.
What about China?
Our military has purchased 2 orbital jammers from the People's Republic of China. Chinese technicians are in Pakistan with equipment right now to teach our officers. In Quetta, I believe. The equipment is supposedly state-of-the-art. They have the ability to disrupt satellite transmissions.
Appleton was utterly confused by this information.
I know what orbital jammers are. What the hell does Pakistan need them for?
I don't know. I don't have sources in the military, but I know China uses them to block transmissions of satellite programming in nations whose sat feeds would be embarrassing to China. Maybe the government wants to use them to disrupt Indian broadcasting.
Appleton understood the larger abilities of orbital jamming equipment. Much of what he knew was theoretical, and he hadn't seen them used in the field in any large capacity anywhere in the world. The news was perplexing, but he didn't see it as related to his main focus. He knew there was a terrorist organization trying to put together dirty bombs on his turf, and that was where his concerns lay at present. He was about to give Emil new instructions when she said,
I want out, Teddy. I need to get out. Now. I know the product I'm giving you is important, but am I not important as well?
You are the most important thing in the world to me, darling.
He grabbed her, hugged her, kissed her, then said,
You know that. I would do anything to take you with me right now and put you on a transport back to the USA.
She pulled away from his embrace.
But?
Appleton sighed.
But we have to take Khan off the table first. We have to find him. We have to find the material he stole, or the devices if he has already constructed them.
Off a look from her, he said,
It's not me. It's my masters. We all have masters. We need their help to get you out of the country. I swear to you that I will take you out of here just as soon as this is all over.
She folded her hands in front of her, looked down at them.
Khan is gone. I told you.
But the ISI will be looking for him and for the rest of the KRF. You are safe from him, but you can still feed me information about his organization. You listen for anything out there that we will want to know about. The Chinese jammers is good intelligence, thank you. But help us find out exactly what was taken at Chashma, or who has the expertise in Pakistan to assemble a dirty bomb. Check with immigration. Has a known bomb maker from Iraq or Syria or Saudi shown up in your nation?
She nodded at all this, but she wrote nothing down. They kissed again. He felt her tremble, and it sickened him to his stomach. Then she stood, wrapped her head in her veil, and began walking off into the darkness. Appleton watched her leave. The cold fear of what he was asking her to do was almost unbearable, but he shook it off, stood, and began walking back to his bicycle. 48. Present day. The dark hippie apartment over the Versova fish market was an unusual location for 3 people to discuss the fate of India. But Ted Appleton, Priyanka Bhandari, and Court Gentry were doing just that. Appleton said,
What I'm about to tell you is known by the government in New Delhi, but it has not been released to the public. 2 months ago, here in Mumbai, a container of nuclear fuel rods was stolen from Dhruva reactor in Trombay. Some 100 kilos in all went missing. It was an inside job. That much is known.
Court's head rose slowly, his tired eyes wide.
You've got to be kidding.
When Appleton said nothing, Court added,
Khan is going to try to do it again, isn't he?
Priya tried to ask how Appleton knew of the theft, but the two American men were too absorbed by their mutual past to hear her.
Appleton said, "You're damn right he's going to try again. That I know. What I don't know is his target or where he's getting his expertise or the other materials he needs for a dirty bomb."
"Or his physical location now," Court added, "which is what matters most."
Priya asked, "Does the Indian government have any leads about the theft?"
Appleton turned to her.
"I've talked to my sources."
Then he shrugged a little.
"My former sources. Now they are just a few old friends who still like to gossip over drinks. Anyway, they say the government thinks B Company was behind the theft. That said, it is their opinion that whoever stole the fuel rods planned on selling them on the international black market. It's a containment threat, a proliferation threat, but it's not a terrorist threat to the nation."
Priya's voice grew louder.
"But if they know Khan is alive and here, and that he did something like this in the past, then the terrorist threat is obvious."
Appleton said nothing.
"Isn't it?"
she pressed. Still, the older American did not respond. Priya looked at him, then to Cobalt, then back to Appleton. Turning again to Cobalt, she saw something register on his face.
"What?"
Cobalt said,
"I think this is where Ted tells us that he hasn't notified the Indian government that Khan is alive, is in India, and is in play."
Priya's mouth dropped open. Appleton just shrugged.
"I learned long ago, young lady, that voicing your greatest fears is the best way to get you put on the outside looking in."
She stared at the older man in disbelief.
"That's madness."
Then her eyes sharpened. She understood.
"No. That's not what this is about at all. You didn't tell India because you want to be the one to kill Khan. That's why you hired Cobalt, my uncle, and me in the first place, instead of going to RNAW. You wanted to be the hero."
Appleton gave Priya a tired smile, with no light behind it in his eyes.
"I'll never be a hero. Not if I killed Khan and 10 more men just as wicked. My die is cast for what I've already done. But RNAW will only help me if I have put the puzzle together myself. Trust me, I've worked with them long enough to know. My job in the security sector was exclusively to fill out papers no one would read, about scenarios no one believed would ever happen."
"But they're happening!"
She all but shouted this, and then she turned back to Cobalt.
"Why aren't you saying anything?"
The younger American replied.
"Because I get it."
He turned to Ted.
"Dropping a dime on Khan to the cops in Mumbai won't exorcise your demons. Killing him just might."
The older man shrugged, a confirmation of Court's statement without admitting it outright.
"I get it,"
Court repeated softly. Then, when Priya was about to grab him by the arm and yell at him, he spoke again, just as softly as before.
"But if a nuclear-laced explosive goes off, you'll meet an entirely new set of demons, won't you? And we can't let that happen. You have to tell your contacts in the government every single thing you know about what's going on."
Priya heaved a dramatic sigh of relief. She obviously thought both of these men were nuts, but at least one of them was beginning to come around.
"I will,"
Appleton relented.
"But what do we know?"
Court said,
"We know Khan is in Mumbai, working with B Company, and we think we know he's acquired spent fuel rods."
Priya said,
"Why would he work with B Company? Isn't he still ISI?
Court turned to Appleton.
"You sent us to Algiers because RNAW learned an officer in the Foreign Coordination Unit was going to be there that particular night. You figured out they were talking about Khan."
And then Court sat up straighter, a look of doubt on his face.
"Or that was your story, anyway."
Appleton said,
"Just a story. I was reasonably certain Khan was here in Mumbai. I identified a known associate of his, a Pakistani security specialist named Nasir Rasool. He was, no doubt, the one who tracked Priya's drone back to her hotel room. Brilliant man, trained and equipped by the Chinese. He's been with Khan from the beginning. They were in ISI together, they were in KRF together, and now he's here."
"How did you find him?"
Priya asked.
"There was a computer breach of the Nuclear Command Authority, the department I consulted for. That's how Khan and his people found out about the transport of fuel rods. I had some of the best minds in the private sector in India retrace the intrusion, and it led them to a location in Andheri East. I hired locals to watch the building, and I caught images of Rasool, the Pakistani technician who used to be ISI, but who disappeared, along with Khan, after the events 12 years ago. I'd always thought Khan was alive, but when his colleague appeared in the middle of the theft of nuclear fuel, well, I knew. I had private detectives tail Rasool, found an associate of his, an Indian in B Company, and bugged the man's phone. He spoke of going with Rasool and the other Pakistanis to Algiers on a mission at the Turkish embassy, and I knew Khan would be there too. Court said, "So it's possible Khan is just working with B Company and not ISI."
Priya shook her head. "There were several Pakistanis there in East Andheri when I was kidnapped. They weren't mob goons. They were sharper."
Court said, "Could be ex-ISI, men who made the jump with him into terrorism."
Appleton nodded.
"And I don't think we should assume B Company is on board with the plan either. Palak Bari, the leader of the organization, lives in Karachi. He's 75 years old, and at this stage of his life, he hates India more than he loves money. He's bombed this nation's government buildings before, blew up an Air India office. He has no compunction about destroying whatever he wants. His foot soldiers still on the ground here in Mumbai are in the gang for the money and power, but Bari has wanted revenge on this nation's Hindus his entire life."
Priya nodded at this. "The B Company man in charge of my kidnapping, his name was Jay. He told me he didn't understand why his boss would work with the Pakistanis."
Court said, "Well then, that tracks with what Ted just said. Bari, Khan, and Khan's men from back home, they are in on the plot. The Indian gangsters, they're just following their nutjob boss's wishes from over the border in Pakistan. Who knows if they are even aware of what they're involved with?"
Priya asked, "What's our next step?"
Court had an answer. "Ted gets on the phone with whoever he can. He tells them about Khan, about Rasool, and B Company, and he also tries to find out where Khan is. I'll be ready to go check out any location he learns about from these discussions."
Appleton nodded. Priya, on the other hand, said,
"Well, I'm not just going to sit here at the fish market. We need more information. We know Khan was at the building where I was being held 2 nights ago. I wish there were some way I could get back into that building and try to get a look at their security footage."
Court shook his head. "Forget about it. We aren't going back in there."
But Appleton had an idea.
"Traffic camera recordings from that time and that location. If we can see the vehicle he used, maybe get a shot of him entering or exiting, we can try to get a plate number. Assuming it's not a rental, that might provide us information about the entity he's working with here in the city."
"He's working with B Company," Court said. "Haven't you been paying attention?"
"B Company doesn't register their vehicles as B Company."
The older man rolled his eyes.
"Shooters."
It was said as a pejorative.
"Again, assuming it's not a rental, it will be registered to a corporation or an individual here, and that is the best lead we may get."
Court understood. He said,
"Murad Khan didn't go to Hertz at the airport to rent a car." "Agreed. He's being ferried around by whoever is supporting him."
Court looked to Priya.
"Can you get into those cameras?"
She shook her head.
"No, I can do a little hacking, but not on a government entity scale. I need a back door into the system, credentials of someone with access."
Appleton smiled.
"I know a guy. For the right price, he'll give up his password so you can get in and take a look."
Court said,
"I'll break one of his legs to show him I'm serious, then ask him if the right price is me not breaking the other."
Appleton rolled his eyes, not for the first time in the conversation.
"Won't be necessary. Violence isn't always the answer.
It's often the quickest answer."
"I'll convince him, don't worry."
Court was on board with the plan. To Priya, he said,
"If Ted got you through the back door of the software, could you take it from there?"
She nodded with certainty.
"With the right credentials, of course I could."
Appleton stood.
"Give me an hour."
And he headed for the door. 49. 12 years ago. For the past few days, Court hadn't seen Julie around Camp Chapman at all. Not that he'd had much time to look for her. Hightower was keeping his men busy, pushing the entire team with day and night training. Fast roping, close quarters battle, radio protocol lessons, low light training, weightlifting, and running, as well as blade and unarmed fighting evolutions. Cort excelled with a gun, with a knife, with hand-to-hand combat, and so on. Individually, he was the best on the team in these disciplines, but he remained the straggler when it came to team tactics, as well as other skills one learns in military special operations. Lennox, for one, chided Six fast roping abilities, asking if he could at least learn how to slow rope so that he could show up on the X and share a little of the fighting by the end of their next hit. But Cort worked hard, he improved, and his need to do things his own way was slowly being trained out of him. Even with all the work, he'd had some downtime in the early evenings, after drills at the shoot house or on the range and before low-light training, and he'd spent a portion of this time each night walking around, hoping to run into Julie. He didn't want to go into the Task Force Intelligence Building. A ground branch officer had no business there unless he was invited, but he hadn't seen her outside the building, nor had he seen her in or around the TOC or the DFAC. He also kept his eye on the bonfire, a nightly occurrence at the CIA base and the de facto meeting place for socializing here at Chapman, but he hadn't seen any sign of the quirky but friendly junior intel analyst. He had overheard Redis and Pace talking to Morgan in the pit the day before, mentioning that they ran into Marquez in line at the base coffee shop, where, according to Pace, Redis made an unsuccessful pass at her. Redis just muttered to Morgan that he thought Marquez was a weirdo. Cort remained out of the conversation and kept up with his work. He assumed that the fact she wasn't around meant that the theory she'd put forth last time they talked, that Khan and his people were working on a dirty bomb, was taking all of her energies and her time. It was 6 p.m. now. He'd just finished cleaning his rifle after some intermediate carbine practice at the range with Lennox and Hightower, and was about to head out alone to grab some dinner before returning for night op training. He stood in his cage with all his weaponry, armor, and other gear, and looked at two sheets of paper zip-tied to the wire at eye level. One was the official Pakistan Army photo of Major Omar Mufti, a stern-faced, clean-shaven man in his early 30s, and the other was the image of Murad Khan that Cort himself had taken in Lahore. He looked at the images multiple times a day, both from these photos and on two laminated cards that he carried with him at all times. These men were the two jackpots on his team's mission here on the other side of the world, and he wanted to be damn sure he recognized these guys if he ever came across them in the field. He broke away from his staring contest with the photo of Khan and walked over to his tiny hooch, where he took off his dirty and smelly brown t-shirt to replace it with a clean green one. Hightower was meeting with Hanley, but Redis, Pace, Lennox, and Morgan were all here, all in their cages or sitting on their bunks. Astereo played some rap that Redis had put on. Cort didn't much care for it, and Lennox declared it white boy bullshit, but Redis protected the stereo from anyone with designs on changing the music. The door opened and Cort looked up, thinking this might be Hightower with news from Vance or Hanley, but instead he saw Julie Marquez peering into the room, still somewhat blinded by the sun outside. She wore a helmet and armor, khaki pants, and a white long-sleeved t-shirt. The other men hadn't noticed her yet, but he imagined his luck wouldn't hold in that regard. He quickly slipped on his shirt and hurried across the space to her, knowing that the rest of the guys would need about 5 seconds before they focused their attention on the interaction between the female analyst and the young ground branch officer. Her eyes had just adjusted to the light when Cort stepped up to her. He said, "Don't take this the wrong way, but you look like you've been working your ass off." Julie looked him in the eye.
"I don't take anything the wrong way. Yeah, I've been working. You too, I guess."
He waved a thumb at the men behind him.
"They're trying to whip me into shape. Or they're just whipping me. I can never tell the difference."
He invited her into the room. They made it no more than 4 or 5 steps closer to his bunk area when Dino Redis's head poked up from behind the low shelves of his hooch.
"What's she doing here?"
Cort passed by the large table in the center of the room.
"She's talking to me."
Now Morgan stood up from his bunk.
"Yet another rule you don't know then. No tits in the pits."
Julie said nothing, but Cort squared off to Redis.
"Are you in high school?" Cort asked.
He redirected her over to his cage, farther away from the other men on the team. Jim Pace, whose nose was still packed with gauze after breaking it in the back of the paddy wagon in Lahore, chimed in now to Morgan and Redis.
"It's just Marquez. She's cool."
Redis stepped out from his sleeping area and walked towards Gentry.
Six is fucking up enough around here to where we don't need to be changing the policies just for him.
To Court, he said,
we have procedures, ways of doing things, lots of rules, but good rules. One, we don't let women in the pit. And two, we don't shoot our fucking teammates. Why are both of those things so hard for you to understand?
Court stood between Redis and Julie now.
I feel bad about double-tapping you in the chest, but I have to say, if I had to shoot one motherfucker in this room, it would be you.
Redis closed the distance quickly, but Julie moved between them now, turned her back on Redis, and looked up at Court.
Do you have dinner plans?
Court heard Pace chuckle behind him. Recovering from the mind-spinning twist of thought, Court quipped,
try to get a reservation, but you have to know the maitre d' to get in anywhere good at this fob.
She didn't seem to get the joke.
I was thinking about the defac.
That works too, Court said,
and then he threw on his armor and helmet, closed his cage, threaded the padlock through the clasp, and pocketed the key. Julie noticed that Court didn't close the padlock in the process.
You didn't?
I know, he said with a shrug. There's a lot of security around here. I trust them more than I trust myself not to lose the key and get locked out of access to my webs.
Soon the two of them began heading for the door. Dino Redis, however, wanted the last word. He called across the room to them both.
You're a prick, Gentry, and you're a fucking nerd, Marquez, you know that?
Court's jaw muscles just flexed in anger, but Julie spoke without breaking stride.
Actually, I prefer the term smarter than you.
All the men, with the exception of Redis, broke into laughter. When it subsided, Morgan said,
Gentry, we've got low-light training at 2100. You're gonna have to be switched on, so don't come back here with your bullshit.
Court reached the door behind Julie. He looked back over his shoulder and said,
I'm going to dinner, and then I'll be right back with my bullshit.
Marquez and Gentry sat at a table in the middle of the defac, surrounded by others, but none close enough to hear. Court ate meatloaf that was filling, if not particularly satisfying, while Julie ate salad with a chicken breast thrown on top as an afterthought. She consumed her meal much more slowly than he did, principally because she was doing most of the talking.
Back there, in your building, thanks for sticking up for me like that.
Court shrugged as he ate.
I didn't do anything.
You did, and I've never had anyone do that for me. I mean, my brothers back in high school, they were always getting into fights with guys who said rude things, but not since.
Well, you're welcome. Redis is an asshole.
And, Julie added with a shrug, can you blame him? You shot him.
Court laughed.
Yeah, but you didn't.
She took a bite of salad, then said,
what do the men in Ground Branch say about me?
Court tried to think of a measured response. He said,
not much. Everybody's pretty busy. Pace said Redis hit on you in line for coffee. That's probably why he was being an ass back there.
Julie cocked her head.
I didn't notice if he did. I'm not good at stuff like that.
Me either, Court confided.
You're not good with what? Flirting with girls?
Court shrugged.
Didn't date in high school. Didn't go to college. Didn't exactly land a job with a lot of eligible females around.
Sounds like an excuse to be alone.
Court didn't necessarily agree with her, but he was uncomfortable with the focus on himself, so he didn't argue. He ate a moment, then looked up to Julie and said,
Hanley likes you. Says you're smart as hell.
Then he added,
he did say you were an odd duck.
She sipped bottled water, then said,
I don't know if I should be offended or if all the ducks of the world should.
I think you just shrug and say, that's just Hanley.
That's just Hanley.
Feel better?
You're assuming I was bothered by what he said in the first place. That's not really how my mind operates.
I'm gonna figure you out, Julie.
It won't be easy.
Neither is finding, fixing, and finishing Murad Khan, but we are totally nailing that fucker. You should be a piece of cake.
Suddenly she turned even more serious.
Has Hanley told you what we found?
Court chewed while he answered,
he hasn't told us anything.
Well, I expect you'll be hearing from him tonight.
Court put his fork down and sat up straighter.
I knew it. You were right, weren't you? Khan is making dirty bombs.
She clarified.
We think he is. We have a line on a location for a portion of his force as well, but I don't think I can say more than that. If Chief Hanley gets authorization to send you out, I'll give you all the full briefing.
Court nodded, took a sip of his iced tea as he thought. Julie put her fork down. Suddenly she appeared emotional, stressed.
I've been looking at all this raw intel for the past 70 hours. There is a good chance they are going to send you, along with the rest, into a very dangerous place, based in part on my analysis.
Court waited for what was to come next.
Vance and the rest of the analysis shop, they respect my abilities, but they treat me like I'm some kind of a computer, infallible. I'm a human being, and I can make mistakes.
Court sensed something in her tone.
You did make a mistake once.
More than once, of course, but one time was different.
What happened?
She looked off across the room a moment.
It was when I was in JSOC. I underestimated the size of a quick reaction force in a nearby village. I had the information for a better assessment, but I was rushed. The op was greenlit before I had everything I needed analyzed. I went with what I had. A team of Delta working with Afghan special forces had raided a compound.
She waved a hand in the air.
No big deal, they do that every night. But then one of the analysts monitoring the nearby village spotted truckloads of fighting-aged males heading towards the contact. A hasty extraction was sent in, and they got all coalition forces out of the compound 37 seconds before 40 armed Al-Qaeda fighters pulled up.
The pain on her face was obvious.
We would have been wiped out if someone else didn't step in to fix my mistake.
Court gave her a little smile.
Like you said, we're only human. We're all just out here trying our best.
He hesitated, then said,
Is that why you left, JSOC?
She shook her head.
No, nobody blamed me but me.
She looked at her plate and said,
Where Hanley wants to send you now. It's the same thing. I don't have access to the information I need to make a complete threat assessment.
What's your concern?
The agency hasn't been looking at this location. It's the responsibility of the Air Force, but I can't get any imagery they have. Presumably they've had UAVs overhead for weeks, but I can only see what's gone on since the day before yesterday.
Which is?
Which is significant activity, but not a lot of personnel. I have no idea of the enemy's size on site.
You've done your best. That's all anyone can ask for.
Court added,
I know you've been working on this with everything you've got. I haven't seen you in 3 days.
She blinked her eyes once, surprised by this.
Were you looking?
Court stared at his meatloaf and ate for a moment. Finally, he said,
Yeah.
An awkward silence overtook both of them. Julie finally broke the stillness.
Everyone is talking about what you did at the mall. Nobody knows which member of Golf Sierra went in alone. They all think it was Lennox or Hightower.
She flashed a conspiratorial look across the table.
I haven't said anything.
Good.
But everyone is saying what you did was incredible. One of the targeting officers started calling you the One.
The One what?
She cocked her head.
The One. Like Neo. In the Matrix.
The what?
She appeared crestfallen.
You haven't seen The Matrix. You haven't seen Big Bang Theory. What rock have you been living under?
Maurice's rock, he thought, but did not say. I don't watch much TV.
Julie sighed.
It's a movie. The Matrix. Keanu Reeves.
Okay.
She waved her hand in front of her face.
Never mind. They are just saying you are special.
I'm good at what I do. Am I good enough? I don't know.
I'm having the same thoughts about myself. Am I good enough?
Court lifted his iced tea and tapped her bottle with his.
Well, from what you're telling me, we're both about to find out how good we are.
They finished their dinner, then left the dining facility. The sun was low, but Court knew he didn't have to be back in the pit until sundown. Julie said,
I've got a meeting in 45 minutes. Want to go for a walk first?
Why not?
They strolled all the way to the fence that ran along East Perimeter Road, then walked along it, with the mountains in the near distance. Gray clouds were building around the white tips of Spingar, reflecting the setting sun in the west. Julie said,
I'm sorry I haven't been around much the last few days.
Court said,
I get it. All this trying to stop a terrorist from detonating a dirty bomb is really getting in the way of your social life.
She smiled at this.
I like it when you joke. I might not think it's that funny, but I can tell you do, and that's good.
You're a bundle of laughs yourself, Julie.
You did it again.
What?
Julie stopped walking and Court followed suit.
You don't smile with your mouth when you joke. You think you're too cool for that, but you smile with your eyes.
Court looked away.
I doubt that.
You do.
He felt like she could see into him in ways no one ever had, except Maurice. Maurice had once stripped his psyche so bare that Court had shown everything deep on the inside. He had an aversion to such vulnerability now, but Julie wasn't Maurice. She wasn't going to hurt him. He looked up at the sky.
Getting dark. I'd better be heading back.
Julie looked at the sky herself, focusing on the east over the mountains.
If you are sent over there tonight, is it okay if I come to the flight line to wish you luck?
There was a softness in her voice that he hadn't heard before, and emotions welling inside him that he was wholly unaccustomed to. He lived a life thinking that no one gave a shit if he lived or died, save for those who merely benefited from his ability to kill. But this was different. This was someone who seemed to care about him as a human being, and he couldn't remember experiencing this before. Ever.
I'd like that, he said.
Julie just stared a moment longer, still and quiet, but it seemed to Court she was deep in thought. Finally, she said,
You and I have a lot in common, and one of those things is we don't really know what we're doing here.
In Afghanistan?
No, I mean, alone with a member of the opposite sex.
Defensively, Court said,
I'm 25. You're acting like I'm some kid.
Julie said,
I'm 27. You are.
He didn't know how to respond.
If you are attracted to me,
Julie said nonchalantly,
then now would be the time to kiss me. If you aren't attracted to me, now would be when you say, let's just be friends. I get it either way. It's totally your decision.
Court leaned forward and kissed her hard on the lips. She kissed him back, put her hand behind his neck, and he followed her lead, doing the same to her. It was awkward with the body armor and helmets, but it didn't slow them down, and neither noticed the added weight or bulk. They stood there by the fence, in front of the backdrop of the impossibly rugged Spingar Mountains, for several minutes, kissing, being comfortable in each other's silence. Court was certain his nerves were showing, but for the first time he could remember, he didn't give a damn. Julie finally took a half step back, and she started to say something with a smile, but then, at exactly the same moment, both of their walkie-talkies beeped on their hips. They answered their radios, and an instant later the two of them were running across the base as fast as they could, their romantic interlude behind them now, because the green light for the task force mission outside the wire had just come down. 50. It was standing room only in the talk at 9 p.m. Golf Sierra was in attendance, as well as Lima Foxtrot, a 16-man contingent of SEAL Team 10 operators from Forward Operating Base Salerno, just 3 miles to the northwest, were also present, many of the men in shorts and flip-flops along with their body armor and rifles hanging haphazardly from slings around their necks or shoulders. 3 junior officers from the 75th Ranger Regiment who'd also come over from Salerno stood in the back. Their 48-man platoon had been tasked to assist this hasty hit as well. 12 CIA paramilitary officers, 16 U.S. Navy SEALs, and 3 Army officers, as well as pilots, co-pilots, and crew chiefs for 10 Black Hawk helicopters, crowded around, all facing 12 workstations with analysts and techs seated in front of computers. Beyond the analysts, Hanley, Hightower, and Dwayne Anderson, team leader of Lima Foxtrot, stood on a low riser in front of a 120-inch monitor showing alternating views of Ismail Zai base. A UAV flew 30,000 feet over the site now, and even to Court, who had zero experience evaluating top-down real-time images of targets, it was obvious there was a lot of activity at the location. Through breaks in the cloud cover, trucks and men could be seen moving about, most around a large building labeled HAZ on the screen. Court had no idea what a HAZ was, and he was too proud to ask, but Lennox leaned over to him after a few minutes and answered the unasked question.
Hardened aircraft shelter. Basically a big bombproof bunker. A concrete structure buried under tons of dirt.
he added.
That's a big one. You could park a 747 in there.
As Court looked at it, he could tell it was the size of a couple of football fields. Lennox said underneath the hill was a hardened concrete and steel structure able to withstand multiple salvos of missiles. He explained it had been built by the Americans to house Global Hawk UAVs 10 years earlier, but now, as far as the intel went, it lay abandoned by the Pakistani army. It was clear from the overhead feed, however, that the structure was in use tonight. Men moved around in front of the HAZ, and trucks were parked out front. The 3-story-tall blast doors on the south side of the bunker were closed at the moment, but a small garage-type door was open and light could be seen shining from inside. The HAZ stood in front of a large tarmac, which gave way to a grassy area and a taxiway that led to a runway, splayed out east to west, running across virtually the entire southern end of the base. And across the runway from the bunker, a row of 6 old and disused-looking aircraft hangars sat close to the wire fence there. Lennox said these had housed Predators long ago, before the Pakistani army used the shelters for MI-17 helicopters when they briefly occupied this remote base in the federally administered tribal area. A Dishka crew-served gun in the control tower was manned by 3 men, and a small armed security presence, perhaps 6 men in all, stood around the front gate. Several pickup trucks rolled patrols around the perimeter, obviously more security for Ismail Zai. The operation to raid the location had been orchestrated over the past several hours, in large part by Hightower from Golf Sierra and Anderson from Lima Foxtrot, with consultation from the SEALs and, less so, by the officers and NCOs of the Ranger Platoon. The first person to speak to the audience was a CIA meteorologist who informed the group that the site would be completely covered in heavy clouds beginning at roughly 10 p.m., and the clouds would linger until the morning sun burned them away. The UAV overhead would be useless other than to provide thermal images of activity at the site, and the helicopters flying into Pakistan would have to deal with the heavy cloud cover as well. Hightower spoke next, and he discussed the insertion itself. The low clouds made a high-altitude jump too risky, and the fact that the target location might possibly contain multiple radioactive devices meant a helicopter fast rope insertion into the compound would be ill-advised. The enemy would hear the helos coming for several minutes before they appeared, and the enemy could simply detonate a device and kill the entire raiding party. That only left one viable option. The men would load up into 8 Black Hawk helicopters with 2 more flying as backup, then fly across the border, nap of the earth over the Spingar Mountains to avoid Pakistani air defense radars, and land in multiple locations, none closer than 5 miles away from the compound. The terrain worked in the Americans' favor, Hightower explained, as Ismail Zai base was surrounded by hills that would baffle some of the helicopter's noise, but the terrain to the east of the mountains and to the west of the base was easily passable, even at night. Hightower said he anticipated the trek from the LZs to Ismail Zai to take no more than 3 hours. All 8 helos that delivered troops, as well as another pair of empty Black Hawks sent in case any of the helos were shot down, would leave the LZ and return to Afghanistan, where they would refuel from a bladder at a forward fueling station erected by Army Pathfinders. Matt Hanley took the floor next and explained that it would be the Army's mission to control the perimeter. The platoon from the 75th Ranger Regiment would dominate and eliminate existing base security, then form a defensive perimeter around Ismail Zai to ward off any quick reaction force the KRF might be able to call upon from Peshawar. The SEALs would go over the wall from the south, behind the hangars across the runway, and then they would cross the runway and attack the main entrance of the HAZ via the garage door on the western side. Lima Foxtrot would enter through the main gate and then hit the command building on the northern end of the base, the same building Golf Sierra parachuted onto a month earlier. The 2 Reaper UAVs flying 30,000 feet above the scene were each armed with a pair of Hellfire missiles, and though they would only be able to see heat registers through their thermal cameras, they could be employed in the fight if a target was identified. One of the Rangers asked about the Reaper's ability to tell friend from foe when using thermal cameras exclusively. Hanley admitted that a friendly fire incident was a real danger in this scenario and stressed the need for good communications back to Chapman to avoid any fratricide. Julie Marquez took the floor without being invited, and she stressed that the latrines at Ismail Zai, while still only indicating that a couple dozen men were present, could be some sort of misdirection if the KRF had other ways of containing their human waste. The chief petty officer with the SEALs spoke up to this.
You mean like
burying it?
Possibly, though that would be difficult to remain undetected. They aren't burying anything outside.
The bearded man asked.
Then how could they hide all that shit?
Some men laughed, but Julie said,
A truckload of chemical toilets kept inside one of the buildings could be used to conceal the true number of enemy personnel at this location.
Vance, standing at the monitor showing the real-time image of Ismail's Zai base, pushed back on this, asking Julie if she'd ever witnessed chemical toilets being used for such purposes by any of the organizations she'd conducted intelligence against. She admitted she had not. Vance then echoed and amplified this, saying that his career was 3 times that of his junior analyst and he'd never heard of this either. Vance pointed out that 2 dozen KRF fighters plus another 10 or so security was the estimated force size, and the joint operation against the base would consist of 76 men, with air support from armed UAVs. If anything, Vance said, this appeared to be overkill. Finally, Hanley addressed the force.
Anything else?
Julie just looked back blankly, neither agreeing nor disagreeing verbally, but Court could tell she wasn't sold. They made eye contact across the room, and he saw a grave expression on her face, as if she now felt she and her team were leading the men seated and standing in the center of the room into a buzzsaw. Back in the pit, minutes later, the 6 men of Golf Sierra worked on their own portion of tonight's raid. Hightower listened to the ideas and observations of all his men, jotting down notes, and then he stood over the map table and gave his instructions. Golf Sierra would hump overland from the LZ to the cluster of buildings just north of the wall of the base, where they would clear the area of any hostiles before entering the small dwelling where Julie Marquez had found evidence that the tunnel from the base led. If possible, the team would access the tunnel and then use it to move into Ismail's Eye, to support whichever force there most needed the help. Hightower didn't love his team's assignment. It was clear they had what all existing intelligence suggested to be the easiest job out of any of the 4 forces being sent to the target. He knew Hanley had assigned this mission to Golf Sierra because they had been run so hard and they were operating with a new man. But still, he felt like he was on the outside looking in. He kept his opinion of his team's assignment to himself, however, and outlined the plan for the others. Hightower said,
If those buildings to the north are housing personnel, you can consider them hostile. Intelligence is showing no innocence in the area, no normal patterns of life or families, and we know of no hostages on location. No reason to be discriminatory with our weapons systems. We can apply lethal power liberally in the village.
Court said,
What does that mean?
Rita said,
Shoot anything that moves, except me.
Court replied,
Marquez said coverage of the area has been spotty until today, some issues with the weather, and with the NSA not passing on their intel in time. The fact is, we don't know everything going on at that site. There could be civs.
We're greenlit,
Hightower said.
We'll avoid civ cache where possible, but our mission continues, and our mission is to clear the residential buildings, then haul ass to Ismail Zai to support forces there. That's it.
Court didn't like the idea of shooting indiscriminately in a little village full of unknowns.
But...
I don't want to hear another word about it, Six.
Hightower looked at Lennox, his number 2.
Anything I left out, Kendrick?
Lennox flashed his eyes at Sierra 6.
Yeah, Gentry. Shoot the bad guys, not the good guys, hoo-ya?
Hoo-ya!
Belted Retus.
Hoo-ya,
Court replied meekly.
All right,
Hightower said.
We are wheels up in 2 hours. Get water and food, then jock up. Full battle rattle. Transport Vic will move us from the pit to the flight line together.
Court felt butterflies in his stomach, a rare occurrence, and he told himself he was still a little nervy because of all that had happened in Lahore. But it was more than that. He had been trained as a singleton, a lone operator, and now he was 1 man on a force of over 100 in the air and on the ground, and even with the training he'd received in Golf Sierra in the past 3 weeks, he still felt very much out of his element. Hightower stepped up to him.
Six, we're taking a walk.
The 2 men exited the pit, just out of earshot of the rest of the team, and then Zack turned around to him.
Do we have a problem?
I'm good to go, Zack. I just have a thing against civilian casualties.
Civ Cas can be a problem in any fight around Wellens. Just do your best.
Court just looked at him.
You can't catch the devils with angels, Hightower said.
We don't get to be the good guys all the time.
We are here to execute U.S. foreign policy as determined by officials elected by places in America you and I wouldn't take a shit in. There's some real pricks in government calling the shots, and we're the ones who have to take the shots. Sometimes they get it right. I've done shit in DevGru and here at Ground Branch that I'll be proud of for the rest of my life, whether that's 24 hours or 50 years. Also, as you can guess, there is some shit I've done that I don't feel that great about. But I process it all like this. I'm a hammer. You're a hammer. You have to accept that. Sometimes the hammer is going to be wielded by a person who wants to fix something. Sometimes it'll be an asshole who wants to break something. I'd rather it was always the former and never the latter. But wishing doesn't make it so. Our country needs dudes like us. I love my country, so I give myself over to the powers that be and hope. When all is said and done, I did a hell of a lot more good than I did bad. Court nodded. He got it. He was in Russia working for AAP. He didn't always know much about his operations beyond what he needed at ground level. His targets were his targets because he was told to target them, full stop. He didn't get a vote. Copy all one. I'll do my best. Zack slapped him on the shoulder and then went back inside the pit. Court stood there, just outside the door, and tried to control the doubt he was feeling about all this. He kept his misgivings to himself. He knew there were enough misgivings about him around the fob to where he didn't need to add to them, and then he headed back inside to his cage, planning to check and recheck every piece of gear he'd be taking into battle tonight. A low mist covered Islamabad's Fatima Jinnah Park at a quarter after 10 p.m., and four CIA security officers stood far from the gas lamps, surveilling the empty green space in the center of Pakistan's capital, looking for indications of threats. The three men and one woman of the detail had been here many times, doing exactly the same thing in exactly the same way, and they never much cared for the assignment. Their chief of station insisted on running an agent personally here in the city, and this created a host of concerns for the men and women tasked with protecting him. No, they'd always approached these in-person agent meetings at the park with caution and concern, but tonight, their collective stress level was growing by the minute, because for the first time any of these officers could remember, Leopard was late to the meet. They scanned footpaths and nearby roads and apartment balconies and the rooftops of office buildings, searching both for the person they wanted to see, the agent, and for people they did not want to see, namely Pakistani counterintelligence officers. Ted Appleton sat alone on a park bench, and just like his four officers standing at least 50 meters away, he gaped into the mist, hoping in vain to see movement, any movement. And if the agency security officers around the park protecting him were concerned, Chief of CIA Station Islamabad Ted Appleton was approaching full-on panic. Emil had never been late without notification, and she'd been the one to call for this meeting earlier in the day. He knew she'd have urgent news for him, and he knew that if she was late, it was due to some sort of personal or operational security threat. And if she ended up being a no-show, with no text or call, then that could only mean one thing. That he'd left her in the field one damn day too long, and she had been compromised by a very dangerous enemy. He shuddered, thinking of this possibility, and he told himself everything would be fine, because that was all he could do. The earpiece that connected him to his security team crackled in his ear.
Boss, this is Bodner. It's 17 past the hour. Recommend we call it.
Appleton knew what time it was. He'd checked his watch every other minute since he'd arrived. He clicked the transmit button under the cuff of his shirt to respond to the chief of his detail.
We wait. A few more minutes, no more.
There was a pause just long enough to let the station chief know that his lead close protection officer did not agree at all with his decision. And then the man said,
Copy.
Appleton fought the urge to simply call Emil's mobile phone now. He wanted to hear her voice, find out if she needed help, but he knew better than to actually pull out his cell and make the call. If she had been compromised somehow, then a cryptic phone conversation with an American would only put her in exponentially more danger. So he sat, waited, worried, and continued to check his watch every other minute. At the 22-minute mark, he knew his own persec was now very much in danger. If he had an agent who had been picked up by the opposition, especially on the way to a clandestine meeting, then there was no way to be certain that the enemy didn't know about the location of this meeting as well. Just as he was about to click his transmit button to tell the team they would be leaving, he saw movement in the mist, approaching up the footpath. He stood, looking into the darkness, as the form of a woman appeared. He began walking towards her, his heart soared, but only for a moment. When the figure came out of the mist, he realized it was Caroline, a CIA security officer on his protection detail. She was still 50 feet from him when he heard her voice through his earpiece.
"Sir, Bodner sent me to collect you. It's time to go."
With an incredible weight in his heart, he acknowledged the transmission and began walking back towards the car they had parked nearby as his security closed on him from all directions. He kept his chin up, put on a brave face for the team around him, but inside, he felt like he was dying. All he could do now, he realized, was return to the embassy, monitor his phone and his email, and seek out any chatter from ISI sources, and wait. He'd do whatever he could for his agent as soon as there was something he could do, because that was his job, and also because he knew without question the missing agent just happened to be the love of his life, and he'd sent her into the jaws of an enemy that had likely swallowed her whole. 51. Present day. The last thing on Court Gentry's mind had been the weather, but Priya had changed that in an instant, calling across the apartment over the fish market from where she sat at her computer to where he sat on a beanbag chair. Court was trying to get Appleton on the phone to check his progress with local and national authorities. He'd left hours earlier, promising to get Priya the intel she needed about the back door into the nation's security camera database. Court was impatient. He knew they were all operating on borrowed time, and he'd been calling every 20 minutes or so for an update.
"Cobalt," Priya said, "have you heard about the storm?"
Court hung up the phone. Without much concern, he asked,
"What storm?"
"A monsoon is coming, moving up from the southwest. Should hit this afternoon. It's been on the news for days."
"I've been a little busy."
"Really? Me too,"
she snapped back. Court ignored her tone.
"How bad?"
35 centimeters are predicted. Winds of 80 kilometers per hour.
"Awesome," he said dryly.
Court converted the numbers quickly. A foot of rain and 50-mile-an-hour winds were nothing to ignore, but there wasn't a damn thing he could do about the weather. The city was accustomed to monsoons, flooding, power outages, and the like, Priya explained, but she also said it would bring the city to a standstill until after it passed.
"No taxis, no trains, impossible streets. Believe me, a monsoon this big will be bad."
Court wasn't worried about Mumbai washing away. He was worried about Mumbai becoming uninhabitable due to nuclear fallout. The storm would be a hassle to his operation, of course, but if he got word of Khan's location, he'd go in whatever conditions he had to do it in, even if he had to backstroke across the massive city. Priya brought Court some chai, and she sat down on the sofa across from him without looking his way. More to pass the time than anything else, Court said,
"Can you help me understand why Bari would go into business with Khan to damage the nation of his birth?"
Priya shrugged.
"I am Hindu, but I understand the oppression the Muslims feel."
"How so?"
"The government in India has pursued a Hindu nationalist agenda for many years. The rights of Muslims are all but ignored. Poverty in that community is everywhere, and police don't go into Muslim areas to fight crime."
She turned to Court.
"And I am talking about what is going on now. Don't get me started on partition."
"Partition?"
1947. The British Empire, what was left of it anyway, carved British India up into two nations, the Dominion of India and the Islamic Republic of Pakistan. This decision led to the forced uprooting of tens of millions. As many as 2 million were killed during the partition. I am an unapologetic Hindu, proud of my nation, but that doesn't mean I can't acknowledge how we got here.
When Court said nothing, she added,
"Your nation displaced millions so that your ancestors could have land as well, did they not?"
"They did."
The door opened. Court went for his gun, but relaxed when he saw Ted Appleton. The former station chief had a sack of burner phones, and he looked as energized as Court had ever seen him. He immediately followed Priya over to her computer, where he gave her an access code to the National Traffic Camera Database.
"What did you have to do to get this?"
she asked. Appleton shrugged.
"Not everyone knows I'm no longer working with Nuclear Command Authority."
In minutes, Priya was inside the database, pulling footage of various cameras that had been recording near the building where she'd been held two nights earlier. She warned the two Americans this might be a lengthy process, so Appleton and Court went across the living room to sit and talk things over. Court said,
"Say you were Murad Khan. Knowing what you know about him, his history, his affiliations, what would your target be?"
"India is the target, obviously. More specifically, it's anyone's guess."
"Where would you put a dirty bomb that would cause the most damage to India?"
Appleton had obviously been thinking about this.
"I'd hit New Delhi. It's the capital."
Priya, while still working on her computer across the room, said,
"New Delhi isn't the heart of India. It's Mumbai. This is the financial hub of the entire nation."
Appleton said,
"True, but both Murad Khan and Palak Bari are from Mumbai. Why would they destroy their own home to hurt the Indian regime?"
"They are both Muslim," Priyanka said. "Maybe they would locate the blast in an area away from large Muslim concentrations."
Court pulled up a map of the city on Priya's other laptop, positioning it between himself and Appleton on the little table in front of the sofa. The two Americans looked at it for a moment. Finally, Court said,
"Priya, take a look. What do you think?"
She remained fixated on the camera footage she was scanning, but she answered,
"I live here. I don't need to look at a map. The most likely target is one of the two main financial centers."
"How do you mean?"
"Bandra Kurla Complex and Nariman Point. An attack against either one of these would have an impact that would last generations."
Appleton said,
"She's right about that."
"Show me,"
Court said. Appleton scrolled the satellite map over.
"Here's Bandra Kurla. I live there. You were there last night," he said. "It's one of the big centers for banking and the economy."
Priya pulled herself away from her screen now, moved over to the computer on the table in front of the sofa, and sat down between the two Americans. She scrolled down to the south of the city, near the water.
"This is Nariman Point. It used to be the only main financial hub until Bandra Kurla grew."
Appleton said,
"Which would Khan pick?"
Priya thought this over, then she pointed to the southern tip of Mumbai.
"He'd pick Nariman."
"Why?"
asked Court.
"Bandra Kurla is much closer to the slums. It has more Muslims there and around there. Nariman, it's on the water. It's the main business district. And it's sort of closed off from the Muslim parts of the city. There are mostly Hindus here. Rendering this entire district uninhabitable, killing a few thousand people who live and work there, destroying the existing financial hub for years and years. This would do more to hurt India than a dozen wars in the north for Kashmir."
Appleton looked at her and then at Court.
"The young lady is absolutely right."
Court zoomed in on the satellite image.
"He'd want to detonate it somewhere high."
Priya sighed.
"There are a lot of tall buildings there."
"A rooftop, maybe,"
Court said.
"And certainly," Appleton added, "he'll wait for the monsoon to pass. Blowing up a dirty bomb in 50-mile-an-hour winds would contaminate the entire city."
"Well then," Court said, "we might have a little time yet to look for his location, and we've narrowed it down from hundreds to dozens, maybe."
"That's progress,"
Appleton said hopefully. Priya went back to her workstation and spent another 25 minutes looking at video feeds until she froze an image.
"I might have something."
Court and Ted rushed over to her.
"A side employee entrance to a restaurant on the ground floor of the building I was held in. 11:54 p.m., three Volvo SUVs all black just pulled up."
The men looked over her shoulder at the three vehicles in the lighting of the alleyway. Court realized this was just minutes after he'd left the area, having reconnoitered the building the night before he assaulted it. He'd walked down this very alley at one point, and he would have remembered these three vehicles if they had been there at the time. After less than a minute parked there, men in casual clothing began filing out of all three Volvos. With the drivers still behind the wheel, eight men went to the side entrance, which was opened for them by someone on the inside. Court and Ted both looked the men over. The angle wasn't great and the light was bad, but when the fifth man arrived under the light at the door, the two Americans both spoke in unison.
"Khan."
"Yes,"
Priya agreed.
"That's him. Now we have to see the plates on these vehicles."
Court looked at the screen.
"That's impossible. You're 20 meters away, and you can't even see the rear of the SUVs from this angle."
"From here, no, you can't. But we just have to follow these cars when they leave until they pass a camera that does get a look at them. If we can do that, I can use software to clean up the images, and we can find out who these Volvos belong to.
How long will that take? He asked impatiently.
Priya said, Not as long as it would take you to find Khan while sitting on the couch making guesses.
Court looked at Appleton, but said nothing. In the end, Priya Bhandari had a clean tag image in under 30 minutes. When the motorcade left the building, it passed under a high-definition street camera. Priya barely had to enhance the image at all before putting it in a paid database her uncle subscribed to that matched car tags to their owners. It took just seconds for a result. She said,
The Volvo is owned by Church Square Holdings and Investments.
Court looked to Appleton.
Mean anything to you? To me? No, but let me make some calls.
Over an hour later, Appleton was the one with information, while Court and Priya waited impatiently, both looking out the window at the darkening clouds and increasing wind. He said,
My sources in local police confirm that Church Square is a B Company money laundering front.
If the police know about it, why don't they shut it down?
Priya asked. Appleton and Court looked at each other and then back to the young woman.
You think I'm naive, she said. I can see it in your faces.
Nothing wrong with not knowing the inner workings of corrupt practices, Court said. That's not naivete, that's a virtue. I assume, and it looks like Ted agrees here, that some B Company enterprises are tolerated by the government. More than tolerated, Ted said. Palak Bari's organization funds a lot of politicians and other leaders around this area.
Priya said,
We need to find out about any physical locations this Church Square Holdings and Investments owns. They have cars, obviously. So, where do the cars park at night?
There was an open-source avenue for this information, and it was basic corporate intelligence and private investigative work Priya had been training on for years that got the job done. She plugged in the company, as well as other companies held by Church Square, and came up with a list of 77 offices, buildings, apartments, and physical storefronts across Greater Mumbai.
Shit, Court said, and then, Any of them at Nariman Point?
Yes, Priya confirmed. 8. They own 2 buildings, a penthouse apartment in another building, plus they have the physical location of Church Square Holdings offices, as well as 4 private companies owned by them.
Court and Ted thought for a moment. Finally, Ted asked,
The buildings owned by the holding company, how tall are they?
Priya focused on her laptop for a minute, then said,
One is 12 stories, the other is 16.
And the penthouse apartment? Court asked.
25th floor. It's in a building called Express Tower, on Marine Drive, overlooking the bay at the southern tip of Nariman Point.
Appleton looked at the map on Priya's computer and saw the building in question.
Could be the place. Worth a look. He then asked, What about the other locations?
Priya pulled up each of the businesses, as well as the main offices of Church Square. They were all on ground floors, or very low floors, of buildings in the area, so they were discounted as potential sites to position the bomb. Priya wasn't as sold as the other two.
Why does he have to detonate the bomb on a building? Why can't he use a helicopter or an airplane?
Court said,
These devices are big. And the bigger they are, the more dangerous they are. If he had 100 kilos of nuclear fuel, he's going to need tons and tons of explosive material. Sure, he could get a cargo plane and fly low over the city, but why bother if he has a skyscraper at his disposal?
Court added,
Still, we don't know for sure, and we won't know until we see Khan or the device.
He launched to his feet.
The guy who trained me used to always say, The map is not the territory. We aren't going to be able to find anything sitting here.
He was excited that he finally had a mission.
I'm going down to Nariman Point to see what I can see around this building.
He looked to Appleton.
In the meantime, tell your contacts at RNAW and the police what we've found. Even if we don't find the bomb, Khan might very well be working from this location.
Appleton nodded distractedly, and only after a moment, but Court didn't pick up on this. Instead, he slipped his pistol in the small of his back and headed for the door. Priya closed her laptop and began packing it as well as a charger into a backpack.
Wait, I'm going with you. If I can get in the building, I can hack into their security system.
Court said.
We're going to need a car. I'm going to have to steal one.
Priya shrugged.
Is that supposed to scare me off?
Just testing.
She looked out the window again.
In a couple of hours, we won't need a car. We'll need a boat.
Let's go then,
Court said, and they headed out the door. Appleton called out to them as they left.
I'll make contact with an old colleague in RNAW. Then I'll meet you down at Nariman Point.
52. 12 years ago. 10 sleek and advanced EH-60 helicopters sat tip to tail on the flight line, their rotors spinning. Powerful electric lighting cast a sharp tinge to the scene, and long shadows danced in multiple directions as 76 men in combat gear congregated near the big aircraft. The different forces were divided by uniform, loadout, position on the tarmac, even age and disposition. The Rangers were both the most plentiful and the youngest, some teenagers, most in their early 20s, and they wore conventional military uniforms, carried M4 rifles, and sat on the tarmac in neat rows, their backs resting against their packs. Their dual-tube night observation devices propped high on their helmets differentiated them even more from the rest of the combat-ready men at the scene. Next to them, the 16-man SEAL contingent were older, in their 20s and early 30s, and they donned better uniforms, better armor, and better gear, and they wielded high-end HK416 rifles and quad-tube NODs. And next to the SEALs, a dozen more men, all at least 34 years old, save for one, wore flame-resistant and moisture-wicking cold-weather adventure wear clothing, knee and elbow pads, and body armor with loaded ammo pouches attached. They carried 416s, same as the SEALs, and similar helmets and NODs, but they looked nothing like the Navy men, who themselves looked nothing like the Rangers. 6 of the 12 CIA paramilitaries had been SEALs themselves, including Zach Hightower, TL of Gulf Sierra, and Dwayne Anderson, TL of Lima Foxtrot. The others had been members of Delta Force or Green Berets, with one unique exception being the 25-year-old brown-haired man standing in the center of Gulf Sierra, who was now looking up at the heavy cloud cover and wondering how the hell 10 helicopters were going to fly through that soup and through a rugged mountain range. Court wasn't even thinking about the danger at the target. His worry right now was focused on getting there. Like the others on his team, he was strapped with 60 pounds of armor and equipment, and his gloved hand rested on his rifle, hanging on his chest by a 2-point sling. His nervousness had only increased in the past 2 hours, and having recently noticed the impenetrable clouds hanging just over the base, he now realized he had something new to worry about. Redis looked over at him, the taller American's face visible in the electric lighting but partially obscured by a thatchy beard, goggles, and the radio microphone that curved in from the left. He wore ear protection and a helmet, same as Court and the others, and his night vision goggles jutted above his head like a crown. All the men carried gas masks in pouches on their hips, opposite their pistols, and each man had at least 2 knives on his belt. Court turned away and looked off down the flight line in time to see a pair of red and white Chesapeake Aviation BV-107s lift off a quarter mile to the east, no doubt taking personnel to another FOB or, if they were lucky, back to Bagram to catch a flight to the States. Court watched their blinking lights until they disappeared in the clouds heading north, barely 400 or 500 feet above the tarmac.
"Look at you,"
a woman's voice said from just behind him. He turned to find Julie standing among the dozens of jocked-up men on the flight line. She was wearing a gray sweatshirt with camel-colored body armor over it, a helmet on her head, and a radio clipped into a front pants pocket of her jeans.
"You look ready for anything."
Court waved a hand up and down his body, motioning to the $50,000 worth of equipment strapped to him.
"Unfortunately, none of this shit is going to help me if the helicopter corkscrews into a mountainside."
Julie looked over at the flight line. She said,
160th, from FOB Salerno. They're the best pilots in the world. You'll have to find something else to worry about tonight.
Court found himself comforted by her words. He stepped closer.
I'll think of something. Didn't think you'd actually drop by.
Why not?
Court shrugged.
I don't know.
Here I am, she said, looking around. Even more testosterone than I'd expected.
Dudes getting their game faces on.
Right, she shrugged. I wanted to see you off. Plus, nothing for me to do back at the talk. Nobody's listening to me anyway.
About the Oppo?
She bit her lower lip, and Court realized he'd seen her do this before they'd kissed earlier. She said,
I keep telling everyone that we don't know the size of the force. Don't let them tell you there are 2 or 3 dozen packs on site. We really have no clue.
Okay. We'll deal with whatever we find.
He was trying to convince Julie all would be fine, which was difficult because he'd yet to convince himself of the same.
"I'm serious," she implored. "Be careful. This is going to be very dangerous."
"If it's not very dangerous, I'm not usually involved."
In Court's headset, he heard Hightower's voice. The man was less than 30 feet away, but all the Hilo's engines made conversation at a distance impossible without shouting.
"Gulf Sierra 1 to all call signs. Our aircraft is Thunder 6-4. We will load up in 2 mics. Skids up in 5.
Court had no idea how to tell one helicopter from the next, but he figured he'd just follow the rest of the group to the right Hilo when the time came, and if he got into the wrong Hilo, he'd sure as hell hear about it from Hightower before they took off. He turned his attention back to Julie Marquez. They were 2 feet apart. Court wanted to kiss her, but he was in view of the rest of his team, so he held back. She said,
"I'll be watching from above."
She looked up at the clouds.
"On thermal, anyway. Right now, the cloud cover over the target is even worse than it is here. Almost totally obscured. It won't clear till daybreak."
"I'll be sure to wave."
She rolled her eyes.
"I still don't think your jokes are funny, but I respect you making one at a time like this."
"Gallows humor. When you're off to the gallows as much as I am, that's pretty much all you've got."
"Are you scared?"
she asked.
"It's okay if you are."
In truth, he was fucking terrified, but he shook his head.
"Nah."
Julie gave him a look of disbelief.
"Why not?"
Then she motioned to the men around.
"They're all scared. They're hiding it. They're controlling it. But they're feeling it. It's the natural human emotion at a time like this."
Court had no response to this. Instead, he stepped forward, moved his microphone out of the way of his mouth, took Julie's head in his gloved hands, and kissed her. His goggles and his helmet pressed against her face and forehead, but she kissed him back, hard. This was a natural human emotion at a time like this, he realized. He couldn't hear the men around him, and at this moment, he didn't care what they were saying. When their lips parted, he remained close to Julie.
"I'm good. Ready to get the job done and get back."
She held him, their armor tight against each other, and then she stepped back. Court nodded, his heart pounding from fear and excitement and desire. There were almost too many emotions for him to process at the moment. Quickly, Julie leaned forward, kissed him on the cheek, and said,
"Come back."
Court nodded.
"I will."
She backed away a few feet, bumping into kitted-up men who looked at her with annoyance, and then, after a quick nod to Court, she turned away, heading back to the hangars at the edge of the flight line. Court watched her leave, then turned away to find Zach Hightower looming over him. The former SEAL Team 6 member had a big wad of dip under his lip, and he spit on the tarmac. Looking at Gentry, he said,
"Fucking horny-assed kids."
And the men around laughed at this. And then, just like that, Hightower switched on. He triggered his push-to-talk button and said,
"Everybody load up!"
Up and down this portion of the flight line, men lumbered towards the helicopters. Court lagged back a couple of steps, following Hightower as they neared one of the Blackhawks. Behind Court, Jim Pace leaned in close, speaking directly into his ear.
"Bad luck, dude."
"What's bad luck?"
"Making out with your old lady right before an op. Don't you ever watch any movies? Those are the dudes that don't make it back."
Court sighed and kept walking. He wasn't superstitious in the least, but he dreaded the shit he was in for about this, on top of everything else.
"You guys have any side bets on whether or not I make it tonight?"
he asked Pace as he walked. The 40-year-old operator just shook his head.
"I'm rooting for you, man, but I'm not risking my cash on it."
"Right,"
Court said, and he followed Lennox and Hightower through the large side hatch of a Blackhawk, then attached a multi-point harness around his chest and midsection and leaned back against the bench with his rifle pointing down between his feet, his body facing the front of the Hilo. He looked ahead in the low light, past Morgan, Pace, and Redis, who faced the rear, past a crew chief behind them who knelt by a minigun that jutted out of the port side of the aircraft. Through the soft green lighting in the cabin, he could just make out the shoulders and helmets of the pilots between their seats at the front of the aircraft. Looking around at the array of screens, buttons, and knobs up there, Court found himself bewildered by the technology. He knew helicopters. He'd been trained to fly both rotary-wing and fixed-wing aircraft in Virginia and North Carolina during his 2 years of intense daily one-on-one training years earlier, but he'd certainly never piloted anything one-tenth as sophisticated as a Blackhawk. He'd flown Bell Rangers and two-seater Robinsons, Though he could understand the basic controls in the cockpit in front of him, he was like a crop duster sitting in a 747. This was a completely different animal. The 10 EH-60s took off more or less in unison. Court looked at the tritium-lit watch face on the